Let's jump in. It's getting to be, as we forecast, pretty much. The South China Morning Post has 7,894 cases allegedly confirmed, 170 dead. Henry Nyman is with us again tonight. Dr. Nyman, one of the world's preeminent foremost virologists. I'm not blowing a horn that isn't worth blowing here. He's right up at the top, worked right through the SARS epidemic and all the horrors of that in 2002, 2003. He is a wizard when it comes to understanding the genetics of viruses. Welcome back, Henry.
Well, it's good to be back, Jeff. It's been real busy. Actually, I've been swamped with the sequences. I wanted to go over some of those results. I think that will shed a little bit more light on the subject, what the, you know, the update that, you just read is, or the confirmed one is pretty much what the national lab, put out for, China. And then, they've tacked on a few more that have come up outside of China. And, since that report came out a couple hours ago or so, but, What they don't have in their report are the suspect ones, and the suspect numbers just keep on going up. And these are cases that have been PCR confirmed at the provincial level, so the kind of equivalent of our state labs.
We covered this before, but for all intents and purposes, the listed suspect cases are already confirmed, as you just said. They should be
right.
Counted in the caseload.
Well, they're usually, a lot of countries will call them presumptive positives. That's what Canada did when they got their first case in Toronto. They had enough confidence that they went and held their press conference saying that they had their first case. And they qualified it by saying they tested in Toronto with a PCR test and got a positive. And then, like most of the countries that follow the protocols that WHO has, it requires a second confirmation at the national lab. And so they sent their sample off to Winnipeg, but held the press conference and said they had their first case, and then it was confirmed at Winnipeg, and generally a PCR positive will be confirmed, and then they held another press conference because his wife was tested positive locally in Toronto, and that was another presumptive positive, and they held a press conference anyway because it was fairly certain that it would be confirmed, and especially since she was the wife of a confirmed case and was flying with him, and there'd really be little reason to think that she wouldn't have been infected, and she was. I'm not sure if that's it looks like that she's been confirmed also now. So they had enough confidence to hold those press conferences, knowing that their local lab in Toronto was accurate enough that it would be confirmed in Winnipeg. And so China does the same thing. And the problem is the cases have gone up so dramatically that their backlog. I mean, their national lab actually is in Wuhan, so yeah. They've just been overworked there, and so the suspect cases, which are really PCR confirmed ones, are now up to 12,167. So that's,
that's
a huge
pushing
number.
20,000 altogether.
Yeah, the two of them together are 19,878. So, yeah, just shy of actually, you know, with the ones they've thrown in since they put these out, this probably is 20,000. And so the confirmed numbers are going up fast enough that is getting people's attention. 7711 is pretty much what all of SARS was. And so that's about the same as the entire SARS outbreak, which, as I mentioned before, ran all the way till May, really. And most of the cases were in April and early May. And at this time in SARS, there were only 300 cases and 5 deaths. And today they announced they have 170 deaths and 124 discharges. So there's still more deaths than there are discharges.
Yeah.
And, well, the comparison keeps on going, and that's the similarities, I should say. And that's part of the reason I was looking at the sequences. And as a comparison, they did kind of the same thing back in 2003. I was following the sequence data, and that's actually how I ended up collaborating with Yi Guan, because I was intrigued by this 29 nucleotide deletion, which he had found. And back then, they were actually releasing the sequences at the sequencing lab's website. So you had to bounce around from lab to lab to get the sequences. And they kind of slowly trickled in. I mean, there wasn't a big delay, but it took a little while. And now they actually set something up with GSAD, which usually just does influenza, but and it kind of gives an advantage because it's kind of public, but it's kind of private because you have to essentially register and indicate you're not going to get the sequences out except in a collaboration, and then it's private. So it stays kind of on the private side. And sometimes researchers in general don't like to put their sequences out there before they get published, because a lot of publications, you know, basically say they only want new data. They don't want anything that's already been made public. And so if they release the sequences, then they'll say, most of what you're talking about is what's in these sequences, that everybody's known about that. And so it's not really new research. So it kind of gets around that problem. For something like this outbreak, though, everybody was saying before the first sequences came out that there's no journal going to turn down your publication because you put out, you know, a sequence in an epidemic, or now it's looking more like it's going to be a pandemic. And but in any event, they GSAD started covering coronaviruses for the first time in this outbreak. And that actually is because one of the people on their board actually does coronaviruses, and I think he talked them into doing it, and they've been putting out phylogenetic trees and 3D pictures of the various proteins. And so they've been showing up there. And I don't have it in front of me. I think it's up to 40 something. There's 40 something sequences of this particular coronavirus, plus one bat. There's one bat sequence, which actually is the closest sequence out there. It's like 96%. And all the rest are human cases, and they're showing up extremely quickly. And I was kind of going through this Shenzhen cluster, and all of a sudden there were a bunch of sequences that came up from Guangdong province, which is where Shenzhen is, and And then sequences came up from France, and France really surprised me, because France was only announced like 2 or 3 days ago. And
that's right.
And there wasn't even that much information, like the ages wasn't out there. At least I haven't seen it. Of course, I've been doing sequences all day, so I don't know. Maybe it's out there now. But and one of the initial part of the story was they announced two cases, one of which was in Paris, and then they said that they may have a positive on a relative. And they didn't really give a whole lot of details who the relative was, or how they were related, or the ages. And then two sequences popped up this afternoon. And with the sequences, they generally do give the age and gender, and the collection date in the hospital that collected the sample, and the lab that.
Let me try and bring this home on a little simpler level for our listeners who don't know what sequencing is. It's a study of the entire genetic makeup of this particular virus, which has made at least one significant change. Now, when you're studying these sequences, how many types of this particular virus are you seeing? One or two? Are you still seeing the early stage, or are we just now seeing that one with the ORF8 issue? What are you seeing?
I'm seeing that it started out pretty simple, and now it's getting pretty complicated. And these complications kind of go to the, there's still this bioweapons type of a thing out there. And so the data really doesn't support that. As either a bioweapons or a study where kind of a gain of function study where they make changes and see if that increases the transmissibility or something along those lines. And the two pieces of data that would argue against this being some type of escape, or deliberate. I mean, some people say, I don't know. You know,
all right, now pay attention to what Henry's saying, that argue against an escape from a biosafety weapons lab, which they have in Wuhan, or some kind of an intentional effort by an enemy of China to turn something loose there. Henry would see
or an escape from a lab that was basically doing basic research on how the virus is latent. I mean, somebody, Wuhan University does a lot of this bat work, and they've identified a lot of SARS-like sequences. And in fact, they're the ones that have the one that's 96% identical, that GSAT. And so they kind of zeroed in on Wuhan University, and they had this ad that they were looking for postdocs that were going to be involved with looking at the mechanism on how the virus is latent and how it becomes more active. And then, that was put out. Oh, they put this ad up. See, they're the ones that are doing this. And, if they were smart, they would have at least taken down their ad, because they got all these guys, Googling everything they can think of. And they pop up with something, and then they come up with a story of exactly what it means, not really understanding what's going on. But in any event, if it was Wuhan University and they were doing this type of research, the same type of research has been done in the past on influenza. And when they take the influenza, they're using a strain like usually the first one that was identified. So there was one that was H5N1 in Indonesia, and they were using the very first human case that was back in 1995 or so. So if they're going to do research, they're not going to take a new virus that nobody's ever heard of and it's never been published,
right.
Then make changes on it and they'll say, well, what does this virus normally do? You said you got it to do, something different. Nobody knows what it did originally. And so they wouldn't choose this, novel virus that nobody knows anything about to actually go ahead and do an experiment. number one. Number two, if they did do it, it would be a very pure form of the virus. And so they would basically have a virus. It would be cloned. It would be, you know, there wouldn't be any mixtures of it. And when this first came out, it was kind of like, well, you know, this virus looks pretty uniform. These different isolates that are coming up, you know, it looks pretty much the same. There's a change here and a change there. And this virus is known to recombine. It was one of the first viruses that was shown to recombine. Actually, that was done by Michael Eye, who was at USC when I was there. He was on the fifth floor. I was on the second floor, and we were both working on RNA tumor viruses. And he did a whole course on viruses and how they replicate. And I took his course, an excellent, excellent course. And in 1992, he published a paper on coronaviruses and how they recombine. Uh-huh. And now, you know, and he went back to Taiwan a few years ago, or maybe it's 10 years ago now. And so he's being interviewed now as the grandfather of coronaviruses, or father or grandfather. I don't know which term. He's kind of getting up there in age now.
So. How's that?
Godfather. Okay. Whatever. But in any event, coronaviruses do recombine. And to recombine, you basically need two viruses in the same host, so that if they're in the same cell, when they replicate, they can go ahead and pick up. They can start copying one version and they'll switch over to the other, but they need two in the same cell. And for them to do that in humans, you got to have a lot of humans infected, because initially the likelihood that one person's going to be infected by two different people that have slightly different viruses is very low. But when you get the situation in China, where there is lots of people that are infected, and therefore you can very well be infected by one or two or three people, you know, a short period of time. So you can have multiple viruses in you. You can have a super infection, and they can be slightly different. And then, so if you have multiple infections, then those viruses can start swapping different pieces, and then you can kind of get accumulations where all of a sudden, instead of having one change over, you know, an X period of time and very slowly evolving, it can start evolving very quickly. And it is starting to evolve very quickly. And that was some of the data that kind of popped up today, because a bunch of new sequences were put in GSAT, and I've been spending all day looking at them.
Explain for our listeners, Henry, GSAT. What does it mean? It's an acronym, but what does it mean? GSAT.
I'm trying to think what all the letters are. It's been around for a while. It has to do with influenza sharing. I think that's what the INS are. INS letters stand for influenza sharing. And the idea is kind of like gene bank, except you have to register and say you're not going to distribute the sequences. Gene bank is wide open. Anybody with an internet connection can go into gene bank. There's no password. And you can share the sequences. Anybody can see the sequences.
To sum this up real quickly, what you've seen is completely within the realm of natural viral evolution. You would see if something really bizarre popped up there. You would see something strange.
Right. And here's what the Googlers saw that they thought was strange. And it really isn't strange at all, because they're working under a misconception. And what they saw was at GeneBank, they're annotated, so the sequence is like 30,000 letters, okay? And it codes for different proteins. And then the RNA, or they list the letters for DNA, okay, but originally the genome's RNA. But anyway, the DNA sequence is listed there. They convert that into what protein that would be, and then they put the protein sequence down. It's all annotated, so it says that it starts at this position and it stops at this position, and if it splices, it tells you it went this far, and then it jumped over here and put it together. And so it's got all the protein sequences listed also. And these guys took a look at a protein called E for envelope, and they thought that this is the protein that determines what cells the virus can get into. It would have the receptor binding domain in influenza, be like the hemagglutinin H in influenza. But that's not what this protein was. I mean, this is called spike protein in coronaviruses, and it's got like 4,000 units. Okay, 4,000 amino acids. It's relatively big. For the E protein, it's only got 75. So it's really small. It's only like 1% of the spike. So it's a little protein, and the virus does do this recombination. So it's not uniform. If you compare one virus to the other, and they're a little bit different, they'll show up as being identical for one stretch, and then they'll be kind of divergent. They'll come back identical because it's recombining all the time, especially like it's in bats. And there's lots of coronaviruses in a bat cave, and basically there's a lot of instances where the same bat is infected with more than one virus, and they exchange the genetic information. And so it's not uniform across. So they, not realizing this, they went and looked at each of the proteins. And when they got to this one, which was small, they saw that the bat sequence that was publicly available in GeneBank was an exact match of this coronavirus, nCoV.
Yeah. Got it. Uh-huh.
And they went and they said, well, the nCoV is a human virus, which isn't true. It's in humans. It really hasn't changed that much yet. So that's a human virus, and this is a bat virus, and therefore they've gone and made the human virus. They've changed it, so it just so happens to match this sequence that's at GeneBank. And so they're saying that the GeneBank sequence has been modified to look like the human sequence. But the reality is that nothing's modified. It's bat versus bat, and there's a stretch of 75 amino acids that's identical in both, because they're really both bat viruses. I mean, one's a virus that was isolated in 2013, and the other one's a virus that was isolated in 2020, 7 years later. But there's still a reason that it's the same, because it goes, you get regions of identity and regions of differences. So nothing was modified to make that region identical. It's just recombined, and it hasn't changed over that small stretch. And so they see identity, and they assume that the identity is due to a modification in a
And bingo, a conspiracy is launched.
Okay. Right. Okay. And so they've got the wrong gene. They got a little bitty gene, and they got a little bit of identity, and you find that all across that comparison. But most of the genes are much bigger, so it doesn't go for the whole gene. And that's why they were basically looking at big ones versus little ones. And they found a little one, there was 100%. In the bigger ones, it was 92%. Or if they were, well, they weren't using this sequence that she said, and I don't think, no, I know they weren't using this. They were basically using the gene bank because he said it's not annotated, and they need the annotation to know where the genes are. But in any event, so that's what, that's the basis of the conspiracy, and it's just due to recombination.
I saw one, yes. Got it. I saw one yesterday. Somebody said that the basic coronavirus was sown and then activated by 5G in the 5G systems in China. I mean, it's getting to be really loopy out there, crazy.
All they do is take a couple things they can Google and then come up with a story that explains why they're related.
It's sad.
Okay.
The saddest part of it is that people buy into it without any questions. They just grab it. Hey, this is it.
Well, no, they kind of have questions, and they take a look at this. I mean, I saw that they got it circled in red, and they say, here's the E gene, and here it is, and it says 100% identity. I mean, the software does it for you. I mean, it takes each one of these down and says how similar one was to the other, and this sequence was published in GeneBank, so like I said, anybody can get the sequence of the first nCoV from a person and then put it up against the sequence in GeneBank. And it was, you know, it was said as soon as the sequence came out that it was a bat virus, and that these two were the highest. They were like 92% identical. And I think I mentioned that it was that it was a military lab that had this sequence out there, and yeah, it's going to lead to all kind of conspiracies because that's the best match at GeneBank. And that's basically what ended up happening.
Let me move on, getting back
to the real data, okay, and what the virus is really doing and why it's concerning. I was looking at the sequences about a week ago or so, and sequences were released by the, I think it was the Guangdong CDC, and these were labeled. There were actually two that were from clusters. One was from a Shenzhen cluster, and the other was from another city, starts with ZU, but in any event, another city in Guangdong province. One had two, the other had three. And I looked at the sequence of the one that had three, and I looked at both of them. But the one that had three changes in it, in three different genes. And one of the genes was this gene called ORF8. And so it's a little gene. ORF stands for open reading frame. And it's they do that because they can see that it can make a protein. They don't know what the protein does. They're not really sure what to name the protein, so they just call it ORF, and they number them in order. So this is the eighth open reading frame in the gene. And the reason ORF8 was of interest is that's where the 29 nucleotide deletion was in SARS coronavirus. And that sequence, I mean, that deletion affected the behavior of the virus. And as a result, it became more virulent and more transmissible. And that deletion was in the physician that went to the Metropole Hotel. And every sequence that was isolated outside of mainland China had that same 29 nucleotide deletion. And so when I saw this, this wasn't deletion. It was just a change of one amino acid from, I think it was from leucine to serine. So it changed the amino acid in this fairly small protein. The protein's only 121 nucleotides, and there, without this change, there were six differences between the bat sequence and this. It's also bat, but the one that's in humans. And this added another one was the seventh one. And, you know, a single change like that can affect the function of the protein and can affect the behavior of the virus. And this was in a cluster of three. So, I mean, it specifically said on each one of these that it was a cluster. And familial cluster. It was a cluster within a family. And the sequences were there, and all three sequences were the same. So they all had, all three of them had essentially the same change. There was one in the ORF 8. There was one further upstream and in a great big, it's called ORF 1A, B, and that's actually most of the genome. And then there was one a little bit downstream in the M gene. And all three of these sequences had the same three changes showing that, you know, it really was transmitted. And then it got a little bit more interesting because the Guangdong province, like all the provinces, has been putting out essentially daily updates. And I went to see, well, how's Guangdong province doing? You know, they're not really that close to Hubei. And at the time, they had 32 cases, 32 positives. They didn't really say how many suspects they had, but they had 32 positives. And they had, I believe, six clusters. And the six clusters had 17 people in them. So more than half the people that had been reported were in clusters. And by looking at where they were in what cities, it was pretty clear that this was probably one of those six clusters. And then a few days later, they wrote this cluster up. And they said, you know, we had this one cluster, and it had, I think at the time they said it had five people in it. And I was thinking, oh, it's a five-person cluster, and this is three of the sequences that are out there, and they're all the same. You know, maybe the mutation in the ORF8 is really causing the virus to be a little more transmissible. And then that was followed by the paper in Lancet. The Lancet paper came out last week, and they described this cluster. That's what the whole paper was on. It was on this cluster. And if you recall, I believe it had five people in it originally, and they went to Wuhan, visit relatives. The relatives were sick. They ended up infecting them. They came back to Shenzhen, and one of the people that didn't go to Wuhan got infected. And, you know, that was more evidence that it was human-to-human transmission, that not only were they infected when they went there, and several family members were, but they infected somebody when they came back. And then they gave the story about they had a 10-year-old that went with them, and he didn't have any symptoms. And they tested him, and he was negative. And the grandparents or parents, I don't know which, but, you know, they insisted that they do a CT scan on the 10-year-old. And they said, he's negative. He doesn't have any symptoms. We did a PCR test. You know, he doesn't have any virus. You know, you don't really need to do a CT scan. And they insisted they do the CT scan. So they did the CT scan, and his lungs definitely had evidence of an infection.
Wow, that's really stealth. That's hidden away. That's hard to find. If you have to use a CAT scan, PCR doesn't work. In other words, it evades the PCR, or it's not dense enough
in
the body.
It's in the lower respiratory tract. It's not in
the
upper respiratory tract.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, okay.
Go
ahead.
And so that was another aspect of this virus, which, you know, as you're saying, you know,
that's really scary. Now, just think about that. I got a point here. Think about that, everyone. If a PCR test doesn't catch it, it's hiding out that low and deep in the lungs that the only way you're going to see any potential damage, which would suggest infection, is with a CAT scan. We got a problem here.
Especially he's asymptomatic. I mean, there was no reason to do the CAT scan other than he was with his parents and they were positive.
And they insisted.
And they wouldn't normally do that.
So we have a plane with 200 Japanese nationals fly back to 203, I think. Anyway, 200, give or take, fly back from Wuhan to Japan. Well, by the time the plane lands, three of the passengers are symptomatic and determined to be infected. That means the entire plane load, the other 197 people, were potentially infected as well with that circulatory air system in that tube that the people were flying in. That's a big problem. And as Henry just said, some of these people show absolutely no indication that they're sick, including evading a PCR test. Man, this is really stealthy stuff.
And the same thing, kind of the same thing happened in the cluster in Germany. We kind of talked about this a little bit yesterday, but this was an employee who was working in the Shanghai office, and she came to Germany in Bavaria and basically sat in on a meeting and then flew back to Shanghai. And on her way back to Shanghai, she started feeling unwell. And then when she got back to Shanghai, she got tested and she was positive. But she was not, you know, she was feeling fine while she was in Germany. Mm-hmm. And then one of the people in the meeting ended up developing symptoms and got tested and was positive. And then three other employees at the company, and it's a auto parts store. You know, it's a large company, I believe. I think they had 11 branches in China, but they sell parts worldwide in their, you know, their headquarters in Germany. And, they were going to test like 30 more people, in that office today, and I haven't seen any updates on it, but there's four in Germany that are positive and one in Shanghai who actually had gotten infected in probably in Shanghai and brought the virus, but she was asymptomatic while she was in Germany and was still able to transmit the virus. So that's another thing that's usually, you know, fairly unusual. I mean, sometimes it happens with flu where people are infectious even though they haven't developed symptoms yet. And so that happened with this coronavirus. And now they've got a four-person cluster there at minimum. And it's not clear what the situation is with other contacts, and they haven't released those sequences yet. But they did release these sequences from France today, and that was it turns out those two sequences were identical. They weren't the same as the Shenzhen cluster. These had two other changes in the
but they both
had the same two changes, and one was a 41-year-old male, the other was a 42-year-old male, the other was a 41-year-old female. So they were probably husband and wife, and or brother and sister, I don't know. But in any event, they did have identical sequences, so they. One probably infected the other, or they both got exposed to a common source. I think they were. They were from Wuhan.
But here's another angle we got to get into, and that's the number of days of incubation. Chinese are trying to say 5 days. I've seen stories that would suggest it's double that. I don't think you can say five.
It goes the other way around. China is saying it's 14 days, and the U.S. is saying.
I beg your pardon. You're correct. I had it backwards. You're right. Go ahead.
China's saying 14 days.
Now that's okay. 14-day incubation period. My point was. It's a long time. And when you got that 10-year-old kid who is infected but shows no signs, and if he can walk around a PCR test, he's infectious, shedding viruses and spreading it around, and there could be a lot of people doing that very same thing. No, don't feel bad. They've got no symptoms. This is bad. We're trying to say 5 days. No, it's longer than that.
Yeah, and that's why people aren't going to get picked up on, another reason they're not going to get picked up on airport screenings, because essentially, if they're
infectious
and they don't
right
really
then and
get
there.
Symptomatic, they're not going to get them on a fever check, and they're going to develop symptoms, long after they land. And so that's part of the reason is concerning. The other reason is concerning is the sequence results. So just to take it a step further, I had these three sequences that were done by the CDC in Guangdong province. And then the paper came out in Lancet, and they said they were going to put their sequences on deposit at uh-huh. Gene Bank, and then they showed up both at Gene Bank and GSAD, and there were only two of them. And I figured, well, this is just a different lab that's doing the same sequence, the same family that I was looking at initially. And it turns out that both of them have the same three mutations, but one of them has a fourth mutation. And that made me kind of wonder if maybe there were two different clusters in Shenzhen. I mean, I knew there were two. I knew there were that many, but there were two that were in the same age group. And I was actually looking at a different Shenzhen cluster than the one that was actually written up. Mm-hmm. But they both had those same three, but one of the two had one extra one, and he couldn't really pair them up because these two, they didn't give their age and gender, so it wasn't really clear whether they were among the three that I had already looked at. Four more sequences from Shenzhen showed up today, and they were done by yet another lab. And, two of them weren't in the same group at all. They didn't have these three mutations. They didn't have any of the three mutations. They were totally different.
And these were from infected people. These are from infected people.
Right. Well, these are from infected people in Shenzhen, actually. Mm-hmm. And so, but then when I looked at the other two, one of the other two was the same as the ones I had seen. And the other one was a recombinant, and it was
a
pretty dramatic recombinant.
That's alarming.
Because it had two of the three. It had ORF8, and it had the one downstream. It had the N protein. So those two were the same, but mm-hmm. the one upstream in the ORF1AB, there were 22 mutations in that gene. And it didn't have the one that was in the Shenzhen cluster. So they had kind of overwritten
alarming.
That. They had overwritten that. And mm-hmm. it just had these string of mutations which I haven't seen before in any of the other isolates that were there. And in fact, when I saw the Shenzhen, I hadn't seen those string mutations in any of the prior isolates. And so as the numbers are going up, A, you're seeing some new mutations that you didn't see originally, mm-hmm. and B, you've got the potential of this type of recombination where you've got one end of the molecule has a whole bunch of changes, whereas normally that end of the molecule is pretty well conserved. And the other end of the molecule, or the gene, is still got the same one. And so this one was a pretty dramatic recombinant, but it still has ORF8. And so that was a little bit concerning. And then to show how it's evolving, all five of the U.S. sequences are out. Okay. And the first one was in Washington. And it had two of the three. So it didn't have the one in the N gene, but it did have ORF8, and it did have the one upstream. And so it might have been a precursor even to the one that was in Shenzhen. So it had two changes. Shenzhen had one additional change. But then the sequence from Illinois came out. And the sequence from Illinois showed that every one of the polymorphisms there was a mixture. So that indicated that that individual had two viruses circulating, or somebody prior had, and they still were. So, I mean, what they were sequencing from his sample had two viruses and gave mixed signals at each of these positions. And so that
this thing is not going to settle down. This is
that one had
like
the three. It had the three that were in Shenzhen, and then it had two more that were mixtures, and then the sequence the sequence in Arizona came out, and the sequence in Arizona ended up pairing up with the sequence in Illinois, but it didn't have mixture, but it had a couple additional changes that was in the Illinois sequence.
All right. We got to wrap this up now. Wrap it up. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, I'm trying to keep it straight. This was actually the Los Angeles sequence that had that. And then Arizona looked just like Shenzhen. So there's a few variations on the theme. They all have the same ORF8 mutation. One had a mixture, and that's why they gave mixed signals. The other was a recombinant. And then some of the other ones had tacked on a few more mutations. One had one mutation less.
So
the virus is evolving, and even with this one lineage, you've got all these different versions of it. And part of that evolution is because the level in humans is as high as it is. And each day these reports come out and the numbers go up. So it's kind of in an exponential phase now. So it's not just going up linearly, especially when you add the suspect on. Yeah, I mean, it might look a little more linear with the confirmed, because it's limited by how many confirmations can be done in Wuhan. And so if they have a limit, the confirmed will go up a little steadier, and the suspect will go up a little bit more dramatically. And that's why there's 10,000 that are in the confirmed. And so the cities are getting bigger too. There's several cities now that have over 200 confirmed cases, and there's starting to be deaths in those other cities. And I think Hebei province, I think, has two deaths now. So, I mean, those are starting
Let me tag on some things here real quick to wrap up this program. Somebody is projecting the geometric progression is suggesting 100,000 of infections in a week. That's a pretty big jump. One coronavirus vaccine expert said it'll take over a year to develop a vaccine, if you can even do it then, that'll be proven to work. In terms of areas, Hong Kong has now 10 infected. Thailand has admitted officially, governmentally, that it is unable to stop the spread of the coronavirus in Thailand. It can't, it's made it clear it can't. First case of NCOV in Tibet confirmed today. Family of four Chinese in the United Arab Emirates confirmed as well. Go ahead, Henry. We got about a minute.
I was just going to say the Tibet one was the one that kind of said it's really all over the place. I mean, that was one that people were thinking, it's not going to get into Tibet. Yeah, because that was one of the few provinces that didn't have any infections yet. And then when that came up, and then, like you say, the UAE had a whole family there, so they had four, so they have multiple ones. And it's just very hard to keep it under control. And you're just going to see more of this. There's going to be more clusters, and Germany is the one, I think, is the one to watch the closest, because that might be a fairly large cluster. And there's going to be other ones out there that are percolating right now, and nobody's said anything yet. And so they're already in these different locations. And, you know, tomorrow I'll give a little bit more overview of how many countries and how many cities have.
That's
one.
We need to hear that too as well. All right. Thank you, Henry. It's really volatile out there right now. It's not stable. It's changing. That's the big message.
Yeah, well, that's what they do. That's why they're alive today. They're kind of survival of the fittest here, and they're always battling to be number one. And unfortunately, it's number one in humans right now is what they're shooting for.
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Henry. Talk to you tomorrow. Okay.
Okay, very good.
Henry Nyman. Dr. Nyman is really into this, as you can tell, as deeply as anybody can get. He's constantly comparing these sequences, watching for changes, and he's seeing a lot of changes. That's not good for stabilizing a virus and even thinking about a vaccine for it. It's on the move. All right, we'll watch it. Back tomorrow night. Crazy times. Take care.